I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of September. We talk about Syria again today because it is an important issue for us to discuss. We'll have two voices with us this hour, not counting yours. I'm sure we'll have many of you who want to call in and talk about this issue. Joshua Stacker joining us the first part of the show, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Kent State University. He teaches and researches Middle East politics, and he's the author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and in Syria. A little bit later in the hour, Jerry Seib will join us. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, and he wrote an interesting piece yesterday on what the president's formula for a legislative victory concerning a military strike in Syria, how it starts not with the opposition Republicans, but with his own Democrats and others. Both of our guests will be taking your phone calls. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Joshua Stacker, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
You're most welcome. Hi.
You have said that what's often said is, and I think you're correct on this, we have to do something. Military intervention is doing something. Strikes will do something. But it's only going to be a temporary reprieve from the longer dynamics of this war. You want to amplify on that?
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, there is a understanding or actually confusion that military interventions actually are humanitarian interventions. And what I would make the argument is that a military intervention is not humanitarian at all, because what that does is, while it causes a pause, using bombs on another population will not resolve a conflict, nor will it resolve the ongoing crisis that countries like Syria are facing with regard to their humanitarian concerns. And so, to put this into a little bit of context, Syria is experiencing the largest humanitarian crisis since the Rwandan genocide.
Mm-hmm.
2 million people have been are refugees. 1 million of those are children. And then another 5.5 million people are internally displaced in Syria. So that's, out of a population of 23, 24 million people, 7 million people have been displaced. And so that's one out of every three Syrians. So if you were to put that in an American context, that'd be 100,000 Americans. Or 100 million Americans. And of course, there's another 100,000 people that have died.
So, a humanitarian intervention, would you be calling for that, and what form would that take?
Well, one of the things you could do is, instead of putting material resources to, bombing or carrying out limited bombing, then what you could do is you could put that money into sorting out how these refugees are being kept for, making sure there's adequate water and food. Right now they seem to be being collected into camps, and the pictures are quite dire.
Mm-hmm.
So, that would be one way you kind of resolve the humanitarian crisis. I read a statistic yesterday that said only 90 Syrian refugees have made their way to the United States, right? So I'm not asking for the, mass importation of Syrians, but clearly, this is putting strains on Jordan, it's putting strains on Lebanon, it's putting strains on Turkey. There has to be a way that we kind of attack those concerns, as opposed to a military strike, which will invariably weaken an already weakened state apparatus in Syria. And then, when you add that to the fact that there's 1,000 documented militias in Syria,
right,
what it is a recipe for more violence.
Mm-hmm. You probably saw, it's getting a lot of attention, the op-ed in the New York Times today from a couple professors, law professors at Yale. I want you to respond to this part of what they had to say. Mr. Obama could cut off any remaining government contracts with foreign companies that do business with Assad's regime. He can work with Congress to do much more for Syrian rebels and refugees, including providing antidotes to nerve agents, which are in short supply.
I guess so. I mean, the problem is that, you know, there's a bit of a hypocritical stance about sort of these, you know, chemical weapons. So, you know, they've changed the discourse to nerve agents. But, you know, there's been no country on the planet that has used these chemical weapons more than we have, going back from Vietnam, but all the way up into Iraq, when, you know, we used white phosphorus in Fallujah in 2004, and then we dumped, you know, 200 tons of depleted uranium on Iraq. So, you know, this is part of the hypocritical side of it, is that basically what it looks like is you're telling the Syrians, like, you're not allowed to have these weapons, you're not allowed to use these weapons, but, you know, we can use them if we want. And so I don't know that the answer is, you know, getting the antidote to, you know, nerve agents or, but clearly I think that what should happen is that you could use what's going on in Syria not as an escalation into some sort of grand conflict in the region and outside the region with Russia and Hezbollah and Iran and Saudi Arabia and, you know, potentially Israel. What you could use this for is a sort of round table for actually resolving all of these big disputes. That's another way that this could be handled. And I think that the argument that was made in the New York Times today by the Yale professors, I mean, it helps at the margins.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, I mean, we have to figure out a way to kind of get all sides back to the table and working hard to come up with a political resolution, or otherwise the killing's going to just keep getting worse, and it's only going to go up.
Mm-hmm. One of our guests yesterday said one of the answers to the political resolution would have to be Russia. I was very interested. I'm sure you've read the transcripts of this President Putin's very long interview with the Associated Press yesterday, in which he said, which is interesting, that Russia doesn't exclude supporting a UN resolution on punitive military strikes if it's proved that Damascus used poison gas on its own people. A couple questions there. One, do you think the administration has proved this? And two, does it give the administration, should they decide to go this route, more room to get people at a round table to determine the future of Syria and other countries in the Middle East?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, Russia, you know, has been playing this card of like, well, use the UN, but then they block whatever goes on at the UN. And so, you know, it's a little bit disingenuous, but the part that I kind of almost agree with is the fact that, you know, it has been definitively proven that chemical weapons were used in Syria. It has not been definitively proven by, you know, who used them.
Mm-hmm.
I read the report that the unclassified report that they released on Friday. It was 3.5 pages long. It was citing social media reports. So I don't know if they're using Twitter and Facebook as evidence or not. You know, it said they saw hundreds of videos. Videos lose context when you don't know where they're coming from. And so, you know, the only real hard evidence they said they have is that they have this leading member of the regime who's reached out and, you know, made the call. And but, of course, we're not going to be able to hear that. So, I mean, it's a bit much to ask us just to believe them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And given the experience of Iraq, I think that the American population should demand more evidence. If there is a call that was intercepted, that somebody is saying, like, we just use chemical weapons on this population, then let us hear it. That would be much more definitive proof than me say, you know, hearing Secretary Kerry say, well, just trust me.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there are 1,000 different groups in opposition to Assad's regime. I think that we don't know various parts of the world's history as well as we should, and you know a lot about Syria. So if you would please take us back to the beginning of the uprising against the Assad regime. Tell us who was involved in that, and have the cast of players, has it become much larger since 2.5 years ago?
Yeah, I think it has. So, you know, I mean, this is a sort of uprising that just went completely wrong. Syria lived under an incredibly dictatorial, repressive political regime, and it was very much a part of the so-called Arab Spring uprisings. So they watched what happened in Tunisia, they watched what happened in Egypt, they saw it happening in Libya, and they said, we can do this too. Unfortunately, what happened is it started in a small town almost on the Jordanian border called Deraa, and there were four basically teenage kids who went out and wrote, the people want the fall of the regime, which was kind of the keystone sort of chant at the time. And the secret police or the state security police rounded up these four kids and they, tortured the stuffing out of them.
Hmm.
And then, people in Deraa just said, like, that's enough. Like, we don't deserve to be treated like this. We're not animals. And that's really what kicked it off. So it was very much in line with the calls that you heard around the region for more bread, more justice, social justice, more democracy. Given that the Assad regime is not nearly as cohesive or as centralized as Tunisia or Egypt was, they didn't have the option to eject the incumbent like they did in Egypt or Tunisia. So the regime kind of banded together and said, okay, we're going to go down fighting. And they did just that. And in the course of this, as the violence started to escalate and it started to hit different parts of the country, you saw different groups emerging. So up north, you would get sort of Muslim Brotherhood-esque groups emerge. And those guys sort of had a bone to pick with the Assad regime that goes back to the 80s. And, you had foreign fighters coming in and jihadi types, and it very quickly descended into sort of a spiral of chaos. And so once the Assad regime realized that it was fighting a whole bunch of groups but there were still a lot of differences between them. I mean, it allowed them. There wasn't a unified uprising. Right? So it was allowed them to kind of pick and choose their battles. And while it's clear that Assad will never, ever govern that country again within those borders, he's been able to maintain sort of key buildings of state and the key machinery of state.
Can you identify, when you have so many groups in opposition, and we've heard that some of them may be affiliated with al-Qaeda, I still don't understand if there are groups that we have pinpointed as worthy of our support and we are supporting them in some substantial way, or if it's so chaotic that it's virtually impossible to determine who the good ones are.
Well, I mean, as these things go, I don't think that there really end up being good guys. I mean, once you break towards violence and once violence becomes the lingua franca of politics, then, I mean, at that point, there's not really the sort of like good, wholesome, inclusive Democrats that, are, machine gunning the regime down. It attracts a certain kind of political actor. There are no good guys to really support. And this is why I think that some of the other op-eds that have been written recently by members of the conservative American political establishment are probably more telling of what's going to happen or what the policy is going to end up being. And it's not going to be some sort of grand bargain that brings everybody to the table and, the U.S. and Iran and Russia and everybody solve their problems and move forward. What it's starting to look like is a redux of the 1980s, of the Iran-Iraq war, where kind of both sides are supported, where they're not really trying to tip the balance in one group's favor or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So what that is, that's about as cynical a policy as you can get. And, coming from the Obama administration, this was not the hope and change you can believe in.
Josh Stacker is our guest this hour. We're talking about Syria again today because it's important that we do so. He's assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Kent State University and author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. Here's our phone number. We wonder what you think of today's developments. Some of you may have had a chance to read President Vladimir Putin's comments to the Associated Press. Senator John McCain, talk about people who have wildly different ideas of what should be done, over the weekend seemed to give indications that he was with Obama on military action. Today is giving indications that he's not, because he doesn't want a limited kind of action. What do you make of all of this? Where do you stand? Do you stand in favor of military intervention, of doing nothing, or in that vast middle space between the two? What do you recommend? Is there a way, as Professor Stacker recommends, that we get everybody at a table, all parties concerned, and talk it out? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. A little bit later this hour, we'll speak with the Washington Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal, and he has written about how the president is making a lot of phone calls and having legislative meetings with people in the Congress in the United States. And now that he's about to attend the G20, I'm sure he's having many of the same conversations about getting support for a military strike from leaders who will be at that summit. To your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number for you to join this conversation about Syria, 800-486-8655. Joshua Stacker is our guest. This part of the show, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Kent State University and author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. Majid is our first caller. Hi, Majid.
Hello. I just joined you, so I do not know if you have covered this question. I'm really concerned if we tip the balance in favor of the hardliners, Islamic hardliners, such as Al-Qaeda groups. Later on, what will happen to the Middle East, to Israel, to United States interests? We have seen this policy of helping Al-Qaeda groups, so-called, or Taliban in Afghanistan, did not pay off. And we still are involved over there. So I'm really concerned about those groups.
You're concerned about all of the opposition groups to Assad? Is that what you're saying, or that it's hard to determine who they are, or we're giving assistance?
It is very difficult to determine who they are. And Assad regime was a secular regime. And now we are going to replace them by hardline Islamic groups associated with Al-Qaeda or directly helped by Al-Qaeda. Remember, one of the leaders caught the chest of one of the Assad soldiers and ate the heart, while in front of TV, and they were filming and was sending a message. Are we supporting these type of groups?
Are we supporting those types of groups, Professor Stacker?
It's unclear. The buzzword in Washington and what John Kerry said yesterday is the opposition is increasingly being defined by its moderation. So whoever is being moderate are the ones they want to funnel the money to. So what does moderate mean in a Washingtonian context? What does it mean when Washington says moderate? Because obviously all three of us could have different ideas of what moderate is. And what moderate means in the Middle East is that, are you friendly to U.S. interests? So if you show friendliness to the U.S., you probably get some money, you'll probably get some weapons. They've been quite slow to kind of dole out these weapons. This is one of the complaints that is coming up. They're going to kind of go through Jordan, it seems like, and stage these groups there. But what Najib is pointing to is actually a really good point, and one that, basically undermines the entire argument that the Obama administration has been making about narrow and limited strikes, and the fact that you have no control over what happens once that first Tomahawk missile, which may or may not have depleted uranium tip, is fired. You lose complete control. So you can even fund so-called moderate good guys, but that doesn't mean anything at the end of the day. So, you know, and while this doesn't mean that we have to support the Assad regime, you know, in a way, what we need to keep our eye on the ball is, what is the best way that we don't see a spike in, you know, more Syrians being killed, more Syrians being displaced? And I just think launching, you know, so-called limited Tomahawk cruise missile strikes, you have no control over what comes out at the end. And so, in very much, we could end up, as Najib points out, with groups that are very, very hostile to the United States and, you know, the existing order.
Thanks for the call, Mark in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I can't imagine that Assad was ignorant of the world view of chemical weapons before he used them. So I'm wondering, what possible military advantage did he see in using them? And another question I had was, will they be able to find out where the weapons came from or if they manufactured them themselves? I think that's an important point.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, Mark, those are great questions. I don't know the answer to the second one. I don't have any background in sort of the chemical, you know, weapons fields and these sorts of things. You know, in terms of why he used them, so there's two competing theories, right? One is that the United States was so consumed with Egypt that he thought he could get away with using them, so he did. And then the other side of that argument is that, well, there was really no military advantage gained by, you know, gassing this, you know, small population in this one area outside of Damascus. And, you know, the range between how many people may or may not have been killed is quite extreme. You know, the French are putting it at like 280, and the Americans are putting it at 1429. So, you know, we don't even know for real how many people actually died. You know, again, we know that chemical weapons have been used. The Germans, the French, and the United States have come out and said that they have proof that it was the Assad regime that, you know, used them. It would be nice to kind of get our hands on that proof.
Mm-hmm. The use of chemical weapons, the moral case is what we've heard. I don't know if we've heard much beyond that, but a very strong moral case that humanity simply can't accept the use of these weapons. We've seen these horrendous pictures of people dying this horrendous kind of death, not the death from a military strike. Maybe it would be more instantaneous, a more humane death. I don't know if you can make that case. But it doesn't go beyond that. It's just the world has to take notice that nobody can use these kinds of weapons, and thus we need a military strike to keep the regime from using these again and to send a message to other people like Iran. If we tell you don't develop nuclear, don't develop nuclear. Is there another way to get – I mean, do you see something beyond that? Is there some other kind of motivation to have a military strike? And if there is, what might that be? Or if that's what it is there another way to get a country to stop using chemical weapons?
Right. You know, these are great questions. I am definitely of a more cynical view of what the Obama administration has been talking about. Even when the president came out on Friday or Saturday with his latest kind of comments on the Syrian crisis, it wasn't about Syrians, right? It wasn't about the people that were dying. It was more about, like, if you use these weapons, like, that's the problem. And so, you know, there's not even a humanitarian intervention sort of rhetoric underneath it, right? This is pure strategic. And, yeah, I mean, when it it's not being strategic for the sake of Syria. It's sending a message to Iran. And this is where this whole kind of silly argument has broken out in Washington. Like, if we don't do anything, we've lost our credibility.
Right.
And, you know, my response is like, under what planet do you think that the United States government has credibility in the Middle East, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the actions of the past 30 decades or 5 decades, if you want to go back to Iran in 1953, that's what's eroded American credibility in the region, not, you know, launching another military strike. And, you know, again, if the administration is horrified by the pictures coming out of Syria, well, you know, they should be horrified at the pictures coming out of Egypt when the military, you know, launches live weapons on, you know, protesters. Or they should be horrified when they see the pictures of, you know, deformed Iraqi children because of depleted uranium that was dropped there during the American invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's about a standard, and you can't uphold a standard if you're willing to violate that very standard. And at the end of the day, the use of state violence against populations, whether it's, lethal force in terms of a bullet or chemical force from a nerve agent, at the end of the day, it achieves the same aid. So, I mean, that's really what needs to change in the Middle East. No more kind of contributing to sort of death and destruction and, you know, the ripping apart of these societies. But, you know, when they talk about the standard only seems to apply at the sort of the target country at the moment.
Mm-hmm. A from Madison, our next caller. Hi.
Hi. Since we brought up Iran, I'd like to also add to that. It's interesting how we talk about the morality of this action and the ethics of this action when back in the 80s, we turned a blind eye. In fact, maybe even there's evidence pointing that we helped Saddam use chemical weapons against Kurds and his own citizens and, of course, Iran. But my question has more to do with what the previous callers have already brought up. Where is the evidence? We know that chemical weapons were used, but where is the evidence that Assad is he really that suicidal, knowing what would happen, knowing just how itchy the West is to jump into this conflict? Is he that stupid?
To me, that's the kind of calculation that I, you know, when I'm sitting at home in my office trying to think through this logically, you know, I can see Assad being, very cynical and thinking that he could get away with it. But at the other hand, like I said, he didn't need it to, you know, change the military balance of power. I mean, they're winning or were winning if, you know, hanging on to power desperately is winning. And so, yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that that we do know that the weapons were used, and we need more information about who used them, and the evidence just isn't there yet.
Mm. A couple emails. Let's get to a couple of these. Dean from New London. I can understand the need to react to poison gas used by the Syrian government on their own people. Yet I'm so very tired of continuous warfare we seem to be in. I think many other Americans may be in the same situation, conflicted. I think he's right. They are, aren't they, Dean? Aren't they, Professor Stacker?
Oh, yeah, no, I think Americans have every right to be very conflicted about how frequently we use our armed forces or ask our armed forces to step into harm's way over wars that aren't explained well, and where the goalposts keep shifting. But, you know, I mean, if we just kind of shift this, while Americans have every right to be, you know, kind of fatigued by these wars, think about the populations that are on the receiving ends of these wars. Think how tired and fatigued they are.
This
past week, you know, there were like 71 people killed in Iraq in one day. So, I mean, you know, cause of suicide bombings and stuff. So, you know, we leave, but those conflicts endure. And, you know, I think that's one reason why we really should be pushing for a political solution. It's not sexy in Washington, and it doesn't win you elections, but that's what needs to happen.
Randy in Sauk County. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Professor. I know these things are complicated, and logic in that part of the country is often far from logic here. I'm sure you'd agree from that. With that. And my children are in the military, and I'm weary, like a lot of military families are, of being fearful of a green car driving down the road and driving in my driveway and telling my child is dead. And what I think is that Obama has a good record now, and I'm slightly willing to give him the credit for struggling to be more transparent than other leaders have been. And he does try to get these things done with people fighting out their own battles while we come in and provide some support. And we do have to stand up for what we do say we believe, so he does try to give some support. He has strengthened our credibility, and the things you say are right. We do need to come and support things we stand up for. He has, I think, made us stronger that way, ironically. And so I'm willing to kind of give him, at this point, the credit of or the benefit of the doubt. I think he's in a tough spot. He's trying to build a coalition, and I guess what I'm saying is, at this point, let's give him credit for in the past trying to do these things without spilling some of our blood.
All right, let's get a response. Professor Stacker.
I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, this could just be a sort of simple ideological difference between me and the caller. Sorry, I didn't get his name. But
Randy.
But, yeah, Randy. Mm-hmm. It could be just a simple ideological difference between me and Randy. I don't feel like I need to give any political leader, Republican or Democrat, any benefit of any doubt. They act, and I analyze. And, you know, if Obama's done anything, he hasn't really expressed an interest into these sort of big, full-on sort of wars without ends, mm-hmm. like Iraq was or like Afghanistan. He likes the sort of wars on the cheap, the sort of like Libya, where you get in, you get out, like nobody really dies from the American side, and it kind of is like, wow, that was a successful intervention. When, you know, you find out, you know, months later when, you know, an ambassador has to die and some of the support staff have to die at an embassy and, you know, Libya, you know, no one can really explain Libya or where Libya is going. People that are Libyan are scared to live in that country. So, you know, not to mention the sort of the drone program and all the sort of extrajudicial killing that gets done in places like Yemen. So, I'm more skeptical. While I respect the people that serve in our armed forces, I'm just very skeptical about what armed forced power, the power of the armed forces when they exert military power, what it can actually do politically. I don't think it can do what they say, what the politicians say that it does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this, while it may not mean a lot for our body count, it will have a body count on that other end. And, you know, you're destroying societies.
Thank you so much for being with us, and we hope you'll join us again. Thanks.
Absolutely.
Okay, Professor Joshua Stacker. He's assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Kent State University, teaches and does research in Middle East politics there, and is also the author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. We go in just a moment now to the political negotiations taking place, the president meeting with members of the, Congress to try to get support for a military strike. Probably will speak to the American public eventually, because support there doesn't seem to be very strong. And, of course, is in Russia right now, I'm sure, trying to get support among members of the G20. So the Washington Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal is joining us in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jerry Seib is with us now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Washington for the Wall Street Journal, responsible for the news and analysis from Washington. And we welcome phone calls as we switch our emphasis to the negotiations taking place for a legislative victory for the president. Jerry, hello. Thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Happy to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So when you look at today compared to yesterday, a legislative victory for the president seems more likely or less likely?
Well, yesterday was a pretty good day for the president if his goal is to get a resolution passed in Congress, which obviously it is. I mean, because you had the big players come out on his side. You know, John Boehner, the Republican Speaker of the House, Eric Cantor, the majority leader, the Republican leader in the House, the number one and two Republicans, as well as Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer. So you had the four leaders of the House, where he's going to have the biggest problem, all come out in favor of some kind of resolution authorizing an attack. You had a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, which became pretty clear, and even Senator Rand Paul, who's an opponent of doing this, acknowledged that in the Senate this was likely to get passed. So that was all good. I think things have gotten a little trickier today because John McCain, mm-hmm. you know, as you've noted, said essentially, well, I want an authorization for use of force in Syria, but I want more than this thing we're talking about offers. I want something that is written broadly enough so the president and the Pentagon can go in and change the balance of military power in Syria, not just attack some sites that might be used in chemical weapons deployment. So he's looking for something broader. Liberal Democrats and Libertarian Republicans are looking for something narrower or non-existent, and so there's some miles to go here before this is done.
And what about in St. Petersburg? What kind of talking is he doing with the G20 leaders?
Well, you know, I think as you also indicated, what he's trying to do is generate some international support. That's important for a number of reasons. One is that it makes people in Congress feel better if the U.S. isn't out there all alone. You know, you hear phrases like, we don't want to be the policeman of the world a lot. And if others are participating or at least voicing their approval, that makes the job at home a lot easier. Secondly, it would be nice if there was some actual participation in this effort, if it's going to happen. The British have taken themselves off the table, and that's a big problem. The French seem to be in. I don't know that anybody else is likely to participate, but that's at least a possibility. And I think the third thing that matters in St. Petersburg, and this is kind of obvious, is what sort of noises come out of Russian President Vladimir mm-hmm. Putin. He's the principal international ally outside the Middle East for the Syrian regime. He's provided it not only with material support and arms, but also rhetorical support and political support at the U.N. And most people in the U.S. government think that ultimately if you're going to solve the Syrian civil war in some way other than just letting the battle determine the outcome, you don't get that done unless you cut some kind of a deal with the Russians. Mm-hmm. And right now, that doesn't seem very likely. But in the long run, there's got to be a serious conversation over time between the U.S. and Russia about whether there's a diplomatic way out of this that involves President Assad leaving power in Syria.
I'm sure you saw the AP interview with Putin yesterday. Was there anything noteworthy about it?
No, I not in my mind, to be honest with you. I think it was fairly predictable. I mean, what he is essentially doing is stating a case against American intervention. I think what's between the lines in terms of the Russian involvement is a real belief that they want to make sure they have a role in Syria. I think the Russian interest in having a role in Syria going forward is more important than their commitment to the particular person of Bashar Assad, the president of Syria. I mean, certainly in the view of people in Washington who follow these things, the potential is there to convince the Russians that, you know, they'll have a voice in what happens in Syria, but that they ought to cut their ties to this Assad guy. He's kind of a loser, and mm-hmm. If they want to be shut out of the process, the best way for that to happen is to hang on too long to a guy who's a losing proposition.
Jerry, yesterday you wrote Mr. Obama's problems on Capitol Hill start with the fact that he has for 2 years been the most prominent skeptic of the idea that he's now advocating that intervention in Syria is in America's interests. So is it just the use of chemical weapons that has made him totally change his mind here? Because he does come from a pretty unusual spot in trying to make this argument.
Well, there are a lot of unusual things about the debate right now, but that's one of them. I mean, you know, in his mind and in the rhetoric of the administration, it is the use of chemical weapons that changed the equation. Now, Having said that, there are people who don't want to give the president the authority to do this, who, as I suggested, they are going to parrot back, are in fact parroting back to him the arguments that he's made in the past that, you know, if the U.S. gets involved, it sort of owns the Syrian problem. We don't want to do that. There's no good outcome in Syria right now because we all have some doubts about the Syrian opposition and whether they're really ultimately friendlier and better for the West than the current regime is. And those kinds of factors are certainly there. And the president's made all those points himself. I think what the administration is probably trying to do here is to cast this slightly more broadly, though, to say that chemical weapons are the problem that demands international involvement. The fact that you have a regime in place in Syria that would use chemical weapons, and Secretary of State Kerry said yesterday, not just once but repeatedly, in the estimate of U.S. intelligence services, that speaks to the character of the regime. And as we see that, we have to have some doubts about whether we can stand by and watch that happen or not. So I think the administration is now talking not just about doing a strike that would punish the Syrians for using chemical weapons, but to engineer a strike that would actually seriously degrade the military capability of the Syrian government so that it doesn't feel that it has the ability, even if it wants to use chemical weapons again. Mm-hmm. That's a different proposition.
Yeah. Let's take an email from Don in De Pere, and I'm sure this a lot of people would have the same question. Why should this fall into the hands of the U.S. to take action against this crazy man? Where is the U.N. in helping to resolve this disregard for human life?
Well, the U.N. is basically on the sidelines, and that is simply a fact. And this was discussed a lot at the Foreign Relations Committee hearing yesterday. Senator Udall, in particular, was saying, well, you know, we've given up on the U.N., and Secretary Kerry said, well, no, we've not given up on the U.N., but here's the reality. We tried to put through the Security Council, we the U.S., a resolution that simply condemned the use of chemical weapons in Syria without even saying who was responsible for them, and the Russians blocked even that. So the reality of the U.N. right now is that the Russian government has an ally, some would say a client, in place in Syria. It's not going to let the international community do anything at the U.N. that is designed to undercut that ally, and the conversation more or less stops there. Now, you can continue to have that conversation at the U.N., but I think that's going to be a pretty fruitless exercise, and I think that's just the reality of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a couple phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jerry is Washington Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal and has been this week mostly writing about the formula for legislative victory for the president when it comes to a military strike. William in Madison, hello.
I have a couple of questions. Yesterday, David Fitzpatrick, he's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel and West Point instructor, had a piece that appeared on the Chronicle of Higher Education. And he asked a couple of important questions, which basically boil down to, why is the method of death more important than the number of deaths, i.e. those killed by conventional weapons versus those killed by chemical weapons in Syria? And why do we get more upset about that? And then I had a question that came to me as I read that piece. Why an intervention in Syria and not Darfur, where the number of lives claimed reaches almost 500,000?
Well, I mean, those are both good questions. And I think the answer to the first, at least in the eyes of President Obama, is that what distinguishes chemical weapons from other varieties of military action is that chemical weapons happen to be the specific weaponry that the international community has come together and banned from use now and forevermore, and that puts the use of chemical weapons in a different category and one where the credibility of the international community, and in particular the United States, because let's be honest, we're the only country that has the real capacity or willingness to do anything about it, is on the line. And that makes it a question that has much broader ramifications than the question of how many people were killed with an artillery shell, let's say. Now, you know, having said that, it's clearly one of the odd things about this is that, you know, some estimates are that as many as 100,000 people may have died in the Syrian civil war. And when a few hundred die in a chemical weapons attack, that changes everything. How do you logically explain that? But the issue is not numbers of death or method of death, but international credibility. That's the explanation, which people can or can't or may not accept, but that's it. On the second question, you know, it's again, you know, why Syria, why not someplace else? You know, President Obama has kind of addressed this and said, you know, look, there are a lot of tragedies around the world. We can't go fix every one. That actually was one of his arguments for not getting involved in Syria. We
right.
can't solve every problem,
right.
including this one. But, you know, again, this goes to your earlier point. Did chemical weapons really change the equation? Well, I think in the end, that's the answer to that is yes.
I'm interested in how he is dealing with this particular group that you think may be problematic for him, and that's the Congressional Black Republicans. Mm-hmm. A letter circulated by Representative Barbara
Black
Lee
Democrat.
Of California. Has he made progress with that group?
Well, the big political opposition is kind of an odd bedfellows coalition of conservative libertarian Republicans on the right and liberal Democrats on the left. And among the liberal Democrats who are pretty vocally opposed to, or at least skeptical about doing something in Syria, is the Congressional Black Caucus. Now, that's a traditional stance by that group. They're not much fans of military intervention, haven't been for some time. Obviously, for the first African-American president, the opposition of that group is a little more sensitive than it would be for some other Democratic president. And there's not a lot of sign yet that opposition has really been worn down. In fact, I actually think that's one of the problems the president faces. It hasn't gotten so much attention in the last couple of days, which is not opposition from Republicans like Rand Paul from Kentucky, who's been very vocal, but opposition from within his own party. If he can't break down the opposition among Democrats, he's not going to give fence-sitting Republicans much incentive to take a chance on his behalf when his own party isn't doing the same.
Mm-hmm. Friends of Israel, you write, may represent the most potent and bipartisan coalition.
And on that, I think that he's made some progress. I mean, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the most powerful Israel pro-Israel organization in Washington, came out yesterday with a statement in support of a resolution that authorizes force. It had been sort of somewhat strangely silent on this for several days, and it broke that silence yesterday, and I think that's important. I think the significance of the pro-Israel group, the caucus, if you will, in Congress is that it's both important and it's relatively broad and it's totally bipartisan. You have liberal Democrats like Debbie Wasserman Schultz, congresswoman from Florida, is also the Democratic National Chairwoman, as well as Eric Cantor, who's the quite conservative Republican
yes.
majority leader from Virginia. They can come together on this issue. And if you're searching for the elusive bipartisan support on a national security issue like this one, and that's clearly what the president is searching for, that gives you a pretty big slice of that if you can keep those people on board.
Mm-hmm. William, thanks. Tom in Thiensville. Hi.
Hi. My question is, Syria would retaliate. If Syria retaliates against Israel and we have very strong pacts with Israel, does that not put us in a complete and total war in the Middle East?
Well, I mean, that's one of the dangers. Retaliation in general is clearly one of the dangers here. I think one of the points that people have made about the question of retaliation against Israel is that while it's not commonly noted or much recognized, Israel's actually struck inside Syria several times in the last few months, going after, and with quite open explanation, going after attempts by Syria, or what the Israelis think were attempts by Syria, to transfer large-scale weaponry to Hezbollah fighters who are fighting in Syria along with Syrian regime forces, but who basically reside in Lebanon and pose, in the long run, a direct threat to Israel. And the Israeli view has been, if the Syrians are transferring heavy weaponry to Hezbollah, and we see that happening, we're going to strike and stop it. And they've done that a couple of times. And the point there is the Syrians have not retaliated against Israel. So while that's a concern, there's an argument to be made that if the Syrians have decided it's not in their interest to pull the Israelis into this fight before, maybe they're not going to decide to do that now. So that's a danger. I think there's also an equally good argument that the Syrians have plenty enough trouble on their hands without bringing the Israelis directly into the fight over the future of the regime. So maybe that won't happen. But, the sentiment is right. There are dangers here. There are plenty of ways this war could spread around the region, and the Syrians might decide it's in their interest to do that. And it's not just Israel. They could easily strike at Jordan, which is providing material support to the opposition. They could strike at Turkey, which is doing the same. If they decide that it's better if they spread this war around and draw in the international community to come to some resolution. They have plenty of reasons to do that already.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Tom, for the call. I know you have a conference call, Jerry, so we thank you ever so much for being with us.
My pleasure to be with you. Thanks for the time.
Thank you. We'll invite you again. Jerry Seib, Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. He's responsible for the journal's news and analysis from Washington, D.C., and spent some time, actually. It's interesting when reporters have spent time living in the parts of the world in which we're discussing. He was in the Middle East, in Cairo, in the 1980s, so he has that perspective as well. And we also thank Joshua Stacker, Assistant Professor in the Department of Political Science at Kent State University. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we'll return with another hour. And I hope you'll stay tuned for it, particularly those of you who majored in English in college. Not many do now. Many used to in years past. Our guest is from The New Yorker. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he wrote a very interesting piece about why teach English that's in the current issue of the magazine. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Rachel Walker, a literacy advisor for PBS's Ready to Learn project about encouraging literacy and reading among young people. News is coming up in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.